Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. In today's episode, I'm talking to someone very special to me because I'm married to her. This is Wendy Newton. Wendy is a Yogi Raj, meaning a master of yoga at Ishta Yoga. And she's also a practitioner of polarity therapy, which is related to yoga. And we like to have conversations over breakfast. So today we're inviting you into our just slightly post-breakfast conversation. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Peter.
How are you?
I'm good.
So we decided that we weren't going to decide on what to talk about today. So we're just rambling like we would do any Tuesday morning in June.
It's a Tuesday in June.
About yoga.
Our favorite subject.
Or happiness. Or the world. Or what I'm calling in this podcast, deep living.
Deep living.
Why don't we talk about deep living? What does that mean to you when I say it?
Wow. Well, it definitely sounds juicy and resonant. It was the most interesting thing you said out of everything. I heard deep living. That sounds like something I want to do.
Right.
And I have a lot of thoughts about it, which we can maybe unpack. But yeah, deep living.
Well, let's start with one.
Okay, let's start with a thought. The first place I go is that we have this tendency in the world at large to think of yoga as something you do in a studio with your body.
Yeah.
And from my training and perspective and somewhat natural inclination, I know this is not, this is just toe in the water, tip of the iceberg. And that yoga is...
Iceberg, that's a good analogy, that what you see of yoga is just like the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. And so, you know, the idea that yoga is something that you live, that it's a way that you live, is very natural to me. Like the Tao. Yeah, exactly. It's a whole system. It's not just something you do. It's something you live. And it has a very specific practice associated with it. And so deep living feels, it feels like a description, really, of what you get when you live the way that yoga teaches you to live.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, too, that all of the things that we, you might say, appreciate in life, all of the richness, all of the wonder, all of the love, the compassionate feelings, all those feelings that are deeper than survival, deeper than superficial. Those are the kinds of things that are like peak experiences. And that the more that we can tap into those experiences, the deeper we're living.
Yeah, I like it. You know, I don't want to go straight to the negative place, you know, to the description of avidya, but basically where it brings me is that, you know, a lot of times we are just in survival mode.
Yeah,
you know,
and things avidya, just for people who don't know it, is seeing things as they aren't. In other words, the opposite of seeing things as they really are.
Yeah.
And from yoga perspective, that usually means you're thinking that what you're experiencing through your senses, this sort of most immediate, tangible world, is it, even though any scientist can tell you that just below your senses aren't registering everything that's around.
Exactly.
So even on the physical plane, that's inaccurate. So go on. Sorry to cut you off there.
It's okay. So for me, it becomes about meeting your challenges. You know, like life is a sort of a laboratory for growth. And yoga sort of gives us the tools and the framework to to do that living in a deeper way. And in a, like, I don't know, you could say more satisfying or more intentional or more conscious way. And when we're not doing that, we're often just kind of at the mercy of our patterning, our the ways that we were brought up, the things that we were taught, the things that the way that the mind sees the world, which is what we call, you know, not real, feels real, and it sort of creates our behaviors in the world. And and to me, that's like a shallow way of approaching life. Not shallow in the sense of like stupid or silly, but, you know, it's not going very deep, right? We're just kind of riding the surface of all that's available to us, creating, you know, easy ways or safe ways or whatever kind of floats our boat a little bit. And yoga and calling yoga or going to the deep living place with yoga means, you know, kind of looking at what's underneath that surface and being willing to work with that as well and to live life on all these different levels.
So not just like affirming that everything is rosy.
Not just affirming that everything is rosy. And also the way that I look at it is that, you know, when we're human, we have a mind and the mind sees things in a particular way. And it's really, really hard to see things differently, right? Mm-hmm. So yoga is about starting at that place where we're all human and we have a blind spot and doing this practice, living in this way that gets us to a place of perspective. It's not an absolute perspective. It's just a slightly bigger container for the thing that we're already involved in. You know, we're not getting out of our individuality. We're just expanding our individuality little by little in this laboratory of life. And that gives, it gives us something, you know, waters of growth. We grow as human beings that way. And
so you said a little bit earlier that it's not real. Hmm. Our experience is not real. Could you elaborate on your thoughts of mm-hmm. that? What do you mean it's not real?
So it gets a little philosophical.
No, that's what this whole thing is about.
So in the very beginning of the Yoga Sutras, it talks about how the mind is always processing information. Always processing. It's the mind that processes. And that vritti. Processing of information exactly is called vritti. Vritti. And the vritti are part and parcel of who we are. It's our reactions to the what is of the context of life. And it's the vritti, not the life, that's unreal. And so when we can see the vritti, when we can identify as the bigger picture of life, or with the bigger picture of life, align ourselves with that bigger picture, then the vritti, especially those that are generated by our own belief systems, become able to shift and move because we see them as vritti. And so it's not life that's unreal. It's our reactions and memories and ways of dealing with life
that are unreal. Sort of personal stories about it.
Our personal stories, our emotional reactions, even our, at the end of the day, even our physical response, right? How we form structurally.
Right.
It's like slower, but it's still a response to circumstance.
Right. We both come from the same lineage. And in this lineage, there's a strong sense of the tantric relationship of us to what is, that everything, and this is where Sanskrit becomes a handy language, because when you say things in English, the definite, then you have to define everything. But when we said avidya, seeing things as they're not, I mean, it's really like what's not true. And mm-hmm. vidya is what's true, right?
So vidya, like, as opposed to avidya.
Right. So in the same way, real isn't exactly real. It's what's not true, right? So like in the tantric perspective, we are both the knowing or the whole of things, the sort of unboundness of what is, and were the experiences we're having now.
Exactly.
But the unreal, the unreality of it, the avidya of it, is when we aren't living deep, when we're not mm-hmm. living in the full depth of ourselves. We're only on the surface. We're only on this sensory piece.
Yeah. And that's a really big deal. You know, I sometimes hesitate to go to the philosophical place, but it gets a little abstract here. But in the sutras, sort of a little ways down the road, it says that there is reality outside of ourselves, right? That we are part of this larger reality, that it does exist, and that there's a reason, like, that we would not be able, the whole structure of life would be untenable, basically, if that weren't true. You know, they really liked to go to the very end of the line of reasoning, and then they came up with, if we weren't part of this larger structure, nothing about what we observe or experience in the universe could possibly be the way that we see it.
There would be no consistency.
There would be no consistency, and there would just be utter chaos. And so we have this situation in which we each see a little piece of the pie of any situation. And then the larger picture has to come about either through our own personal growth of awareness or through a community's growth of awareness and sort of consensus around how we're going to live with this reality that we're experiencing.
Right.
Which takes us in a whole different direction, but...
No, but it's interesting because, you know, right now in our political societal world, people are doing just what you said. How are we going to deal with the situation that we've
exactly.
find ourselves in?
And because we're human, we're going through this big restructuring of how we're adapting. But there's a lot of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of argument about what's real, what's true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a strange place.
Right. So a deep living would not shy away from participating in any of that.
It
would give you a framework for doing that.
Mm, this is a good direction. I like this direction. I've been chewing on this for a while. How do we...
For about 130 days.
Yeah, exactly. How do we react and respond to this situation? And I've kind of been coming back to a place where I have to step back so that my responses are not emotional reactions, especially to people who I consider allies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually easier for me to talk to somebody who I feel is just confused. Do you know what I mean? Like somebody that I don't know, or even somebody that I do.
Right.
Yeah. But it's harder for me to speak with students that maybe have a lot of activist inclinations who are out there fighting the good fight and angry, and they're a little angry with me for not going to the rally, for taking the bigger picture that the other side isn't the, you know, dark, evil influence on the world and taking us down, but rather a confused polarity to what we're experiencing on this side, quote unquote, in rabbit ears.
Right.
You know, that it takes a lot for me of, I don't even know what you would call it.
I think they were kitty ears, actually.
Yeah, kitty ears.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of persistence on my part to stick to that place, because I've seen in my work how staying in that place where I'm acknowledging my involvement in the world, but at the same time also standing in the place where I, as an individual, ego-driven human being with emotions, am not engaged, right? So how do you be engaged and not engaged at the same time? That's the essential question for me,
right?
As a yogi,
right.
And that's what we have to cultivate. It's right there in the whole, in the basic structure of yoga, which acknowledges the three gunas, which
right.
you can then talk about.
The three gunas.
Yeah.
Here, Peter, talk about the three gunas. Yeah. Rajas, tamas, sattva. The fact that all of nature is active or passive or in the still place between, moving between one and the other.
Mm-hmm.
So yoga would advise us to try to get to the sattvic place, not to be overly active, reactive, one might say, or overly passive, withdrawn, but to try to find the still point, like the eye of the storm, from which you can view things with perspective. This word perspective keeps coming up.
However, if I could add to this, I think there, as I'm listening to you in the context of this conversation, I'm hearing the place where I think people get confused, which is that in yoga, when we say in yoga, we're looking for the still point or the balance point. It's not that we necessarily, there's no authority about what is sattvic or what is the balance between this and that, or the balance that makes us always sattvic, but rather it's a way, going back to that idea, of being able to find that sattvas in the middle of any storm, acknowledging that we are in the storm.
And we will be pushed in both directions.
And we will be pushed in both directions. And the idea is to self-regulate a little bit, like how, you know, to notice when we've gone too much into sattvas. I mean, actually, that's possible. Sometimes people get a little too sattvic, but it's actually tamasic, right? They get a little too like ducks and geese and everything's fine.
Right.
Right? But it's not fine.
Right.
And that's, I think, the pitfall. But, you know, in this world that we're looking at, we see so much rajasic and tamasic activity and we're pulled into it. And how do we... You know, where do we locate ourselves?
Yeah. Well, we have our own experiences of that, of trying to deal with life, quote unquote, in pussy hat ears. But, you know, I see it in students all the time as they practice for a period of time, whether they take a training or they see you privately for a while, or they're just coming to class with a regularity and asking questions, that they are able to have the emotional ups and downs of life, but they are able to right themselves quickly.
Right.
Oh, this was really hard, but I see it's just, you know, and I'll be okay, or I am already okay.
Because they're dealing with what is.
Yeah.
And not getting caught in the vritti. Like, how can you have a thought and then let it be a thought and not have 10 other thoughts on top of it that are judgment or, you know, self-recrimination or anger at something external, right?
Right.
Like we can have a response to something in the world without letting it spin out and take over our whole experience.
Right. There's that great story that both of us like about a father and a son, and how event after event occurs, that, you know, oh, isn't this great? You have your son has, you know, been chosen for the army, and whatever it is, the father says, maybe.
We'll see.
Yeah. And with each step in the story's unfolding, what seemed like it had been a good thing turned out to be a bad thing. What seemed like it was a bad thing turned out to be a good thing. And the father, though, was able to stay in a non-reactive place, obviously engaged in the living and the raising of his son, but without attaching good and bad
to those individual events.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And to me, that always ends up having a better outcome in terms of deep living, because you're willing to live the life that's in front of you rather than a life that you
wish were
in front of you or came up with in your head or that was told to you
to
live.
Right.
And I think I hear that as one of the biggest things that people are challenged around is, you know, at some point they sort of wake up and go, wait a minute, I didn't choose this.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with more of the interview. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, Please support Peter's podcast by subscribing. You can set your own value for the information and effort it takes to make this podcast by contributing whatever amount you choose at patreon.com/peterspodcast. There's a link in the show notes, or just type in patreon.com/peterspodcast, all one word. And thank you for listening.
One of the biggest things that people are challenged around is, you know, at some point they sort of wake up and go, wait a minute, I didn't choose this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come to yoga and they get some tools around how to let that go little by little in favor of something that they're actually, that actually authentically expresses who that more of who they are.
Right.
And, you know, that's a big deal. It's been a big deal in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think most people who come to yoga don't come thinking, I need my life completely saved. I'm going to go to this class on Fifth Avenue. That's 19th Street.
Do some downward dog.
Yeah. And yet when you come from whatever, and I would call it intuition or your drive toward evolving in a spiritual way, for lack of a better word, in English, you know, that there's something that's pushing us all to understand life and ourselves more.
Yeah.
And it drives, right now in the Western world, it's driving many people into yoga. And this is why I feel so strongly about the need for good teachers in yoga, because if a teacher only knows how to put you in downward facing dog and even has fixed ideas about what that should look like, then there's a tremendous missed opportunity.
Yeah.
But, you know, even that will evolve. So I'm not too worried about it. But it's always such a blessing when someone walks into a class thinking they're going to do downward dog and walks out talking about how relaxed they feel or how de-stressed they feel. Or I remember I taught a class in Ishta Yoga in Manhattan, where we both teach, once, and a woman came up to me at the end of class and said, I'm visiting from Colorado. That was such a nice class. I really liked that thing we did at the end where we just sat there and didn't do anything. What's that called?
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard for people to see the big picture when they're not, when nobody knows what the big picture is, or only a few people do, you know. It's, and I like that idea of intuition. I think that, you know, we do see that so much. You know, for me, being an Ishta yogi and being sort of in the hub of, you know, the belly of the mother there at 11th Street, and staying there and kind of just day in and day out and week in and week out, just teaching classes, teaching trainings.
And having access to Alan Finger. And,
yeah. That, well, that kind of goes with, you know, like being in that community that he's created so consistently over such a long period of time, which, by the way, is in the Yoga Sutras, allows me to see that it's almost like an ecosystem, right? The lineage has set up this ecosystem of yoga, and I feel like there's this, you know, people come in and they go out and they get something, you know, they're gonna get whatever they're capable of getting. But from my perspective, it becomes really, you know, I almost kind of get to this place where I'm involved, but not involved. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to state it. It's almost like, you know, how the cells of the body regenerate every 7 years. Like there's no cell in your body that was there 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that with the Ishta lineage community, it's its own energy. It, you know, the individuals that create it, you know, it is, a, you know, it's a community in that sense. It holds together.
Mm-hmm.
It has a structure. It has a way about it. It has teachings that come through it. And, you know, it definitely holds a perspective of the yoga teachings that allows for deep living to start to happen for people. And I think that's incredibly, like, I feel really honored and privileged to be there doing that holding of space in that way.
Right. In fact, sometimes it's sad, maybe is the right word, of when you get a trainee who says, oh yeah, but I teach in a X, I teach in a gym, I teach in a studio where they don't really talk about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. You see that a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, it's less and less, you know, more and more, even in a gym, somebody's going to be open to doing some practice that is called mindfulness or just being quiet, you know, not.
Yeah,
but yes,
you know,
it is a special privilege to be in an almost an urban ashram, you know, which we used that word for a previous project we did. But Ishta is a bit of that, you know.
Well, there has to be somewhere for people to go where the practices are intact and taught in an intact way.
Yeah.
And not watered down. You know, you've been doing this thing, you know, this writing for meditation that has to take out all the language of yoga in order to make it, you know, quote unquote, marketable or palatable for the everyman or every woman. And I respect that too. There's a place for that. You know, just like there's a place for an asana class in a studio that's not the full spectrum of yoga. But at the same time, I feel like there has to be somewhere that you can go to get the full range of the experience of what it is, which if it's not going to the spiritual place, it's not the full range. Just that's it. Like if you're talking, so this is where for me the rubber meets the road, mm-hmm. because I think that if you're talking about meditation without talking about spirit or spirituality, it doesn't have to get into religion. Like religion is a fixed version of that.
Yeah.
According to various traditions.
Right.
But then at the same time, if you say meditation is not spiritual and it, you know, it's just meditation, it's just of the mind.
Right.
Then you're missing, I think you guys are writing a book about this very thing right now, but I think then you're missing a piece. And I really, I don't think everybody needs to hold that space of the full spectrum of yoga, but I think somebody has to.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you just said in light of this conference I attended a couple of weeks ago. It was of scientists who've been working on yoga research and doing serious studies like at universities and whatnot. And while there are a lot of challenges to getting results that are what those scientists called high quality results, sort of like standardized tests with proper controls, etc. There's a lot of study. There were over 3,000 studies in the current NIH database, if you key in the words yoga and some other relevant words. But I asked a question sort of tongue-in-cheek, because one of the researchers mentioned this feeling of oneness that people have when they meditate. And it was in one of the study questionnaires. And he said, you know, I mean, that's one of the outcomes of meditating is a feeling of oneness. And in yoga language, in Sanskrit, we call this oneness, everyone is part of the same thing, we call that Brahman. Right. So I wrote the question for the Q&A session. If we get a large enough sample size of people who experience oneness, is that proof of Brahman? He liked that question
a lot. See, that's back to my thing about consensual, you know, the ecosystem of the right. of the community. Right.
Right. But to your point, you know, if everyone meditates, if enough people are meditating and they're having this experience, it's outside the realm of religion. It's yeah. that human beings have the capacity to feel this sense of oneness world, with their surroundings, and that's really significant.
And when
many people
do,
are missing that feeling.
Exactly. And they're missing it. The flip side of that is that when they do feel that oneness through their own engagement with their own spirituality, with or without the participation of any religion or structured organizational, administrative,
dogmatic
mm-hmm. body, when they have that experience, it changes how they relate to life.
To life.
And it changes the patterns of their vritti, and things change.
And these are the outcomes of yoga.
And these are the outcomes. And the problem for me about research is that, you know, when the research is done without that awareness, then it gets technical.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, I actually woke up thinking of this very thought that I'm about to say. So a lot of times people call themselves healers. I'm a healer. To me, that is a, you know, what is, it's like an oxymoronic statement, actually. Like, I am not the one who's doing any healing. There is no doing of healing. Healing happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I may hold space for some kind of healing to occur. And healing just means when our patterns shift and they reframe and get re-related to. And so to say, I am the healer, shuts the whole thing down. You can say, let me get sattvic and pay attention.
mm-hmm.
And let's see what
That's
happens.
That's your role as a healer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, the hardest thing for me to teach, and I think the most vital thing that I, you know, I've struggled to understand it, and then I've struggled to teach it a little bit, is that very thing, that we are our own instrument. The healing comes when we do our practice and then live our life in a new way, and then we can just literally model that for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And here where they're stuck and struggling.
But it can't be modeling in terms of like posing, because that's what so many teachers who've gotten in trouble have done. They're like on the exterior, they're acting like they're
well, it's
better
because
or good
they think they got caught in the eye.
Right.
They got caught in the ego identification. And it's very, very hard when you do start to get some taste of it and you go to that place where you see, you know, people are looking to you.
Right.
And it's hard to step to the side of that and say, you know, when I say model, let me backtrack a little. When I say model the behavior, it's I'm always checking in with my, like what I sometimes think of as like my human animal.
Yeah. You're walking the walk of
I'm
being
walking
a
the
yogi
walk
practitioner.
And just doing that, you know, I'm always floored how my perspective on things is just really, really different than most people's. And I've learned to respect that that's because of the work I've done in yoga. And that's valuable because it's not, I don't get sucked into somebody's perspective. I'm always checking in with my response and their response and my response and their response and finding the place to relate to them in a quote unquote sattvic way that feels like it can give them a little bit of an awareness that they didn't have
mm-hmm.
in some sort of safe way. And when I ever go to the place where I feel like I have to help them, I have to fix them, I have to take this home and work on
it.
I
have to know more than them.
I have to do anything. I step back because mm-hmm. I know that's the first red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard to communicate to people in this world, I got to say. Mm-hmm. It's a really...
Well, we're a world that values what's the word? Specialist.
The specialist, right. The technician, the report, the study, the thing.
What's that phrase, the cult of personality?
The cult of personality. But moreover, it's, you know, what do they call it? Definable outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I'm all for progress and change and efficacy. Absolutely 100%. But if I set that as my goal, if you come to me and say, I want to lose 20 pounds, and I say, great. I'm gonna make you lose 20 pounds. I don't even know what that looks like.
Yeah.
But if somebody comes to me and says, I want to lose 20 pounds, and I take that in as their intention, and I do everything I can to line up behind their intention so that they can then find a way to re-relate to whatever in their life is keeping them from losing 20 pounds.
Yeah.
And reframe that issue.
Yeah.
Whether it's physical, emotional, spiritual, or mental.
Right.
Then I'm doing my job and healing's happening.
Right. You're helping them have a practice that leads to the outcomes that they're intending.
Because think, it's always subjective. If somebody who weighs 110 pounds and is 5'5" comes to me and says, I need to lose 20 pounds, that's really different than somebody who's, you know, obese coming to me and saying, I need to lose 20 pounds. It's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have to be really specific.
Right.
You know, it's yoga. There are tools of yoga. If we just randomly give the tools of yoga and we don't know why, we're not really doing yoga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember there's this lovely story from Swami Satchidananda. I believe it's in his version of the Yoga Sutras about a teacher who was always anxious because he was trying to come up with something new to teach, as though if his students came and didn't get something fresh from him, they would stop wanting to pay him for coming to class. And Swami Satchidananda said, oh, we just do yoga.
Yeah.
We do the same thing all the time. And when the people leave, they feel really good. And then they come back.
Yeah. Yeah. And isn't that just so true?
Yeah.
You know, and we don't have to talk about it as much as we think we do. Do you know what I mean? The outcomes or the process.
Yeah. Which is not to say that we don't engage and try to help and try to see if there's something obvious that could change, like in your example, you know, what's this situation with your diet and your exercise? I mean, obvious things, of course, you can address, but I think always there's an underlying non-deep living going on.
Exactly. There's a problem. There's always a challenge somewhere.
And for it might be, you know what? You have a kapha body type, and so you're always going to be a little heavier than somebody with a vata body type.
Exactly. So that's, you know, one potential outcome is just reframing the way they see their own body and getting some validation around that, you know, they don't have to have a different body. That's so common, you know, because we see the world of images of especially female, but also male bodies, well, and everything in between, frankly. And, you know, there's no, yeah. Like I said, once we get to the place where we're not going in there to fix,
right,
or be a technician,
right,
you know, it's like outcomes can sometimes be surprising, and fixing and healing are two different things. Like in the healing model, you could say that somebody who comes to lose 20 pounds and then, you know, however many months later walks out the same weight but with a different attitude has completely
healed,
experienced healing,
right,
whereas the outcome on the survey would show no gain.
Right, right.
Right? So for
me... In the laboratory test. Unless it included a questionnaire on enlightenment.
And that is always... I think the problem with surveys is that they're not often asking the right questions.
Yeah. Well, what's cool is that one of the researchers who presented at this conference, her project was to create the categories in which you would survey, like to try to standardize what does yoga mean.
Right.
And it included many, many factors. I think she came up with 31 factors.
This is where, you know, when I was doing that internship at Sloan Kettering, you know, I had access to like the best of the best of the medical field and its research. And it was astounding. You know, there were people working, I don't know what they call it, but, you know, across all of the interdepartmentally. So it wasn't just all different ranges of doctors, but it was, you know, doctors and nurses and administrators and researchers and, you know, kind of working as a cohesive team. And when somebody would get an idea about researching something, they would pull together these teams and just go at it in the most incredible way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's definitely has, I was in actually awestruck with the amazing effectiveness of the work. But it takes a lot to lay that groundwork, especially, I think, a lot of resource, both as money and mind, you know, yeah. Smart people.
Yeah.
But that goes to deep living as well.
Meditate.
Or you can just meditate. That's kind of always been my preferred way.
That's the beauty of this practice, is that, you know, Patabi Joyce, who founded the Ashtanga school, had this saying, practice, all is coming.
Practice, all is coming.
Yes, and it's profound, you know. I mean, and the practice that his school created, you know, it, just like all things that are in the manifest world, there are challenges, there are great things, there are things that you could quibble with and whatnot. But that phrase, I think, really sums it up. It's like, this is a way, do the way.
It means go to your tools. Yeah. Go, you know, when all else fails, when there's no perspective, when you're in avidya, to go back to that word.
Yeah.
Do your practice.
Right.
And that is the way.
And one of the tools, and this is one of my favorite tools, is teachers. You know.
Yeah.
Teachers help students.
Yeah.
Figure out how to use the tools, which tools to use, how are the tools working, and also provide what you said, that modeling. Mm-hmm. How do you do this? How do you walk this walk?
And it's a relationship.
Yeah.
Any teacher that I've ever had that has learned me anything has been somebody who eventually became my friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mark Whitwell once said, to be a teacher, you need to be a yoga teacher. You need to practice yoga.
Have a practice.
And you need to want to help people.
Yeah, relate with them. Relate to them in a heart-to-heart, honest-to-God way. And that's, you know, I don't think it gets any deeper than that in terms of living, right? You know, that's what we're here to do. We're here to relate. We only have each other. And if we're doing that, we're relating and we're growing. And when we stop doing that, we get stuck.
Yeah.
You know, and there's something about where this conversation went about the need culturally that we have to fix it and quantify it and prove it and spin it for gain is very detrimental to the actual relating of, like, I wake up every morning, I do my yoga, and then I be in my yoga and you come see me and we do yoga.
Yeah.
It's like there's, and that's about living and how we live and, you know, how we grow from this laboratory. That's life.
Of life. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that sounds awesome. I am psyched that I get to have this conversation basically every morning, but we'll record some more.
Yeah, and I'll be your special guest. I'll do special guest appearances when you need a little comic relief.
Yeah, that sounds good. And if people want to know more about you, where can they find out more?
Oh, that's a tough question right about now because I'm working on my website. But once it'll be in the show notes, folks, when the website is up. But more to come.
Yes,
you can always find me.
Namaste.
Namaste.